Ladies, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here in the second hour. We are speaking with Jim Fetzer and Ulle Damegård about their latest book, which of course features a lot of different topics and a lot of different authors. And as it always is with these kinds of topics, when there's a lot to it, we don't go into that much of great detail about every single one. There's just not isn't just enough time for it. So we're kind of scraping the surface and trying to get an idea of the importance of the subjects and detail some of them. So by all means, do check out the book for yourself if you want to find out more about these topics. But there's much more in the book. Some things which are fascinating, many things I'm aware of, and some that actually we haven't spent time before talking about. One of these things, maybe we briefly can talk about this, but Paul McCartney, I've heard about that going around for years, that he was replaced. And tell us, Jim, why did you want to focus on this topic? How did that fit in with everything else?
Heinrich, let me just mention before we go there, because it's such a fascinating topic, how much I admire the work of Ulle Damegård. I have interviewed Ulle on The Real Deal, so another benefit of having the opportunity to access that link to my video shows is you'll be able to see Ulle and me do two-hour interviews, another of which we have scheduled just about 2 weeks from now, so that's another reason to go there. I also, since he observed that we hadn't mentioned all the authors, let me go through the list because it's a very impressive collection, including Jay Wiedner, Nicholas Kullerstrom, PhD, Yvonne Wachter, Robert Furoson, PhD, Thomas Dalton, PhD, Anonymous Scholar, Mike Palachek, Jim Mars, Winston Wu, James A. Larson, James H. Fetzer, PhD, Zen Gardner, and Sterling Harwood, JD, PhD. Many of them will come up in this part of our discussion about Paul McCartney and then in following about Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. So the answer to your question, Heinrich, is if you could replace the most conspicuous figure in the world and the world not take notice, you could replace anyone. And Paul appears to have died on, ironically, September 11th of 1966. Some have the date as November 9th, but that's by inverting the month and the day, which is done opposite in UK and in the USA, and that the Beatles were at a great loss, where Ringo raised the question, what do we do about the band? Brian Epstein announced the following month in October that the Beatles would no longer be touring on the basis of the absurd explanation that they couldn't even hear themselves singing because of the noise of the crowd. Well, that's simply ridiculous. Musicians live for the adulation of their fans. I mean, it's the last thing a famous band like this would do unless there were some extraordinary circumstance. And then we have the following July, the release of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And once you put all of the evidence together, and this is something that only can be justified in retrospect after you've reviewed, for example, the forensic evidence that establishes that we are talking about two different people, Paul before and Paul after, who's often referred to as the false Paul or Faul, F-A-U-L, that it's actually a burial service for the original Beatles. You got a grave there, and it says right on it, Beatles. You have the four original members of the band in dark, all more or less in black, and then you have the new band in its glory with all their uniforms, and you have the new Paul, who's taller than the old Paul, but the whole thing is so fascinating, fantastic, that most of his fans never even noticed what was going on or what the cover signified.
Yeah, it's a good point, though, as a kind of an experiment of doing it in a less, I guess, conspicuous setting initially of trying and to see how much can you get away with without people noticing? Maybe the timing was just right. Maybe it was one of those opportunities. They realized that they could operate on it and try to figure out what to how to go forward. But it's also the aspect, I don't know if you guys go into this in the book, but there's also, of course, the aspect of how instrumental the Beatles and many other bands might have been at the time of the so-called British invasion of course, how pop music was launched into this, etc. So the Beatles had to continue any means necessary, correct?
Well, I think that is true. as of, you know, late 1966, because they had so many legal contractual obligations. I mean, it was a huge industry. I mean, I'm going to surmise it was a $1 billion industry. I mean, the Queen doesn't knight her subjects for ordinary, merely intellectual purposes, but because they bring great renown and income or revenue to the United Kingdom. So I think that was also the case. But where we had this fascinating phenomenon, I think part of the reason the Beatles were so successful in the U.S. was because the invasion occurred in the aftermath of the death of JFK. You got JFK assassinated on 22 November 1963. And I think that the country, you know, was in a state of grief. We were mourning his death. And this fantastic music from this most amazing band had the effect of reviving them. I went through that myself when I was a young man. My mother died when I was 11 years old, and I went from living with my mother and stepfather to living with my father and my stepmother, and it took me quite a while to revive, and it was because I had designed a new bedroom in the back of what had been formerly a screened-in porch with built-in bunk beds and so forth, and there was a little platform above each of where our heads lay. And I had to put a radio in there, and I used to listen to what my stepmother called my beer hour. It was called Lucky Lager Dance Time. And all this great music, Shaboom and Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Sincerely and all this stuff that was just classic, you know, 60s hits that we still hear today astoundingly. I mean, I can hardly believe this music that had the effect of reviving me emotionally. It really brought me back from a state of despondency to a degree of enthusiasm. And I believe that part of the Beatles phenomenon was because it had that same effect of reviving the spirit of the people, especially the young people of the United States in the aftermath of the loss of the most loved president the country has ever had.
Interesting. Ulla, have you looked into the Beatles at all and the surrounding wave, you know, that came?
I tell you, I think the Beatles is a very, very interesting topic because there's so many things around that group that you got the official story, as with all of these conspiracies, and then there's a totally different picture that appears once you start digging into it. And I totally agree with Jim says that there's even theories or some facts showing up that the Beatles, the release of the Beatles going big was almost made like as a distraction to also get the attention away from the Kennedy assassination. It followed just a few months after this, and the whole world started looking in that direction. There's a lot of evidence, said to be evidence, that the Tavistock was involved in the creation of this group, this band. And also, if you look at from 63, 64 until 69, the change, I mean, we're talking about a band that, which hairdo shocked the world just because they had a fringe. And then in 69, when they ended, the whole youth movement was on LSD.
Yeah,
you know, that's right. And this is just 5-6 years. And then you look into the CIA and other agencies like that, how they experiments and pumping in this stuff in to destabilize society and so on. And also you see, like Paul died violently, if he died, I totally believe he did in 66.
So how did he supposedly die?
As far as I know, they were in the studio a late evening and there was a row between John and Paul. He got upset, left, Joe picked up a hitchhiker, it was a rainy night, and skidded off the road and crashed and was, he died in this car crash. She survived. And then the whole thing came up with, oh my God, we need to make a cover up. Why this cover up? This is the big question, because either it was just to get a band to keep the revenue, to keep the whole thing. The official part, if there is an official part, was to save a lot of young lives, you know, that these fans would be commit suicide if Paul died and so on. But I think there's a more darker, sinister agenda behind it. Because to pull a thing like this off with all these operations to alter the double and get him to look as alike. I mean, this is a major operation. And why would that be done? There's also, you know, like you can listen to quite a few public interviews on which he keeps referring to him as Fall, not Paul, Fall, very clearly. And also there are some signs of that John Lennon, the week or two before he was murdered, called George and said, I'm going open with this. I've had enough. I'm going to tell the world about what's going on. Then 1 week later or two, he was taken out. And then George as well was almost assassinated. There was a man that entered his, managed to get through all of the security, went into his house and stabbed him. So he almost died. And then you have Brian Epstein, their manager, who also died from a suicide, they say, or whatever it is. But there's a lot of the signs of when there is such a thing going on, people have a tendency to die very young. And we see the exact same signs here. But when it comes to the current Mr. Paul McCartney, I would say if you just look at the forensic evidence, the size of his skull compared to the rest of his body, his body length, which is totally different to the one before 66, his teeth, it's not the same person. And there's especially two forensic experts, in Italians, that have devoted many hours and I would say years of studies that are totally clear with that this is not the same guy. No way.
Yeah, we've had the supposed to double then longer than the real one, right? And so that's why people have become familiar with him and his style. Do you think that the music behind him has been obviously orchestrated, or did they manage to find a person who actually has an interest and dedication and talent in music? What do you think?
No, he is talented, but totally different. You know, he's right-handed, Paul was left-handed. All of these things, they had to do a lot. He had to change. That's also why they stopped doing live performances, according to this theory, because he just wasn't up for it. He wasn't good enough for it. But then if you compare the Lennon-McCartney, these songs, and the whole beautiful way they're built up and incredible harmonies and all of these things, and then you have the music of Paul McCartney's band, Wings, it's a totally different style, totally separated.
Yeah.
And it's said that when he died, Paul and John had already written so many songs that was just on standby to be recorded, that they said they decided we have enough to be able to pull this one off together with cooperation with George Martin and so on to do the whole thing. It's really, you know, what is it called when you become this shield type of thing when you get knighted? There's three Beatles in it, George Martin's emblem, or what you call it. There's three Beatles, not four. The symbol of three Beatles in his weapon.
The coat of arms.
That's the one.
Okay.
There's, yep. But when you look at it, when you really start looking into the things, this is not a new theory by any way or form. It was right in the 60s. It was there in the 70s. It's been this guy.
You're breaking up a bit there, Ola. Maybe we can just switch over to Jim for a little bit, and then we can pick up and finish that thought once the connection gets a little bit better here. But Jim, tell us what more you would want to say about Paul McCartney and the Beatles, and because obviously a little bit later we'll get to some of the other doubles here that you guys have talked about. But let's get to the rest about Paul here.
Well, it's a fascinating case, Heinrich, where I had a collaborator, someone I invited to speak at the Vancouver hearings, the second international conference I organized for scholars for 9/11 truth, a woman from Toronto by the name of Claire Kuhn, who had done a huge amount of research on the Beatles and on the death of Paul. And she had quite a sprawling website devoted to it. But I kept pressing Claire for the forensic evidence, you know, proof that we actually were dealing with two different people. And I would discover, as Ole mentioned, in the Wired Italia, which is the Italian version of Wired magazine, two Italian forensic scientists undertook research that was published in 2009, relatively recently, in which they set out to disprove the hypothesis. They thought they could show that, in fact, it was the same person before and after, but they wound up proving precisely the opposite. Using photographs of them singing, where you have to open your mouth, they could compare their palates, their teeth, and so forth. There are so many photographs, you can compare the size of their skulls with one another, and they're just different on so many dimensions. Paul had bad teeth and a small palate. Fall had normal teeth and a larger palate. Fall's head is larger and more oblong and has a more mature look. Paul's rounder, more youthful and exuberant. We even have photographs of Paul and Fall with the same woman, Jane Asher, to whom Paul was originally engaged, and you can see very clearly. In fact, I like this one so much I put it on the back cover, where you can see that Fall is about a half a head taller than Jane, whereas Paul and Fall were about the same height. Now, it's most interesting that in relation to the actual, what appears to be the death scenario, the accident that Ole was describing, where there was an argument in the studio, and Paul left, and it was raining, and he pitched up a hitchhiker, and she was so enthusiastic that it was Paul McCartney that he distracted her, and going through an intersection, he was hit in the side by a car and ran into a telephone pole, and Paul was trapped in the car and was unable to get out when it burst into fire, and he was consumed in the flames. So that appears to be a bona fide case. And then, of course, the band was distraught. What do they do to continue? My own inclination is to believe that the show must go on. You know, the idea of keeping the band in moving forward was primary, and that the cover-up was more or less an inadvertent development where they suggested using someone as a sub. And the music's quite different, only made some important points, because the close harmonies that were so distinctive of the early Beatles didn't occur thereafter. And I think it's no doubt because the substitute, the replacement, Fall, simply couldn't sing with the John and Ringo and George the way that Paul had. And where, you know, one of the most astounding chapters of the book is by James A. Larson, who grew up in the music world. His father was the leader of the Four Preps, and he evaluates a half a dozen different candidates. And I think, frankly, Heinrich, that James has put his finger on who appears to have been the person who replaced Paul.
Oh, really? Interesting. Now, Ulla, we kind of were breaking up a little bit there when you were talking about basically the coat of arms.
No, I just want to point out, in this book, there's so many different details that are being brought up that shows to a very different or version than the official version. And the thing you mentioned is just one of many things is that George Martin's code of honor has three beetles in it, the symbol of a beetle. There's three, not four. And also Ringo has in an interview said, well, I'm the only living beetle.
The last surviving beetle, yeah.
It was a slip, or
but
is it
also
like
you
a...
have like, yeah, you tell me, I don't know. It's like, but it's when the whole thing adds up, it's just like in the hundreds of all of these weird things going on. Also, Paul's reaction when John Lennon was shot. I mean, he was totally, couldn't care less. When you see it, you can find it on YouTube. It's like he's just standing there chewing gums, does not care at all. And this is not the Paul that at least they used to be
from Liverpool, who grew up with John and where they formed the most famous band in the world, the most successful ever, and whose music in its complexity I compare even with Mozart and Bach.
And then also we have the wife. We also have the wife of Paul McCartney, or the new one that has gone out in many big TV shows, saying there's this massive secret. I'm being threatened in many different ways. I'm risking my life to step forward like this. There's this gruesome secret surrounding Paul McCartney, my husband. I still love him, but this needs to come out. So what is she talking about?
This, of course, is Heather Mills, Heinrich, and she has explained she has a box of evidence about this, and if anything ever happens to her, it will be released to the public. So, you know, she got a $40 million settlement in the divorce, which is rather extraordinary, all things considered, but which could be regarded as hush money in essence. So there are too many, as Ole is suggesting, there are too many indirect signs. There are all kinds of clues internal to the music. The Abbey Road album appears to be showing the participants in a funeral where John in white is the clergyman. Ringo in black is the undertaker. George in denim jeans and a shirt is the gravedigger. And Paul barefoot and out of step with the others is the corpse. I mean, it goes on and on. I think it's very, very difficult to weave a coherent narrative. But the key to it is we're talking about two different people. If it were not for the forensic evidence, I would say, well, it's going to be a source of endless speculation. But the forensic evidence is there. It's included in the book. It is good as gold. We're talking about two different people, and therefore the whole story is utterly fascinating as a mystery that has an explanation.
But if they do, maybe final note on this here, but Abbey Road, the record and the cover I'm looking at it right now, and you're right, of course. But this means then, Jim, that they want to tell you about this to a certain extent. They play on this, right?
Yes. There was an article that's been characterized as Ringo's confession that came from what seems to be a shell website called the Hollywood Inquirer, where he said when Paul died, they were at a loss as to what to do, and they decided to go forward, and people didn't seem to notice. They'd made the substitution. I think it had to do with them not doing any more touring, so they were performing in a studio, not in front of a mass audience. And that the further down the line, they became more and more concerned that their fans might turn on them if they learned the truth, but that they wanted to get it out. So they gave a lot of clues and a lot of signs and a lot of symbols. In retrospect, I don't think they could have done anything more blatant than the cover of Sgt. Pepper, but there it is, you know. And there are so many things internal to many of the songs that have long-time fascinated fans. There's a whole subculture here of the PID, the Paul is Dead subculture, of which I was previously unaware until I began to do research on all of this, and then it was simply overwhelming. But it was for the, you know, piecing it all together in a systematic way and to be able to show the science of it, that the forensic evidence substantiated there were two people, and then all the pieces fall into place.
Yeah, interesting. I've as I said, never talked about it in detail, and I always knew that there was a lot to it, so it's interesting to hear some of this material. But speaking of doubles, though, obviously, sometimes then they keep them or bring them in to keep it going. In other cases, it's the double that they waste. let's speak a little bit more about both Saddam Hussein and Osama here. I guess if we follow the chronology, let's begin with Saddam and what actually happened to him.
Well, it's rather fascinating because I was contacted in relation to my radio show by a woman by the name of Yvonne Wachter, explained to me that she was the mother of the B-1 bomber pilot who'd actually taken out Saddam. This was long after the mission accomplished event on the USS Lincoln off the coast of San Diego, which somehow fell flat. It seemed very much incomplete. And she explained to me how he'd been on an assignment when he was given a new set of coordinates. He was told it was the big one. He dropped two JDAM bombs on a restaurant in the outskirts of Baghdad, leveled the building, and when he got back to his base, he was lionized, put on CNN. He'd be awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, and he apparently took out Saddam, his two sons, and 50 or 60 members of their general staff. Believe it or not, I mean, when Yvonne contacted me and told this story, I thought it was a fascinating story. Could she substantiate it? And she started sending me one article document after another. I was just simply overwhelmed by her ability to do research. And it turns out she's actually very skilled at that. She's a court certified legal stenographer, and she is with a, you know, certified by investigative services in California. And among the many sources she sent me was one from the New York Times stating, after the war, Baghdad, U.S. begins to excavate bomb crater and search for Hussein's remains. It quotes Vice President Dick Cheney saying in a speech that last month he believed that Hussein had been killed in that raid. I think we did get Saddam Hussein, Mr. Cheney said. He was seen being dug out of the rubble and wasn't able to breathe. Well, there's a monster amount of additional evidence, including from an Australian reporter by the name of Joe Viales, who noticed that there was a difference between the double and the original Saddam, interestingly enough, in relation to their teeth and their jaw. where Saddam had excellent teeth and in an overbite, meaning his upper teeth goes over, go over his lower, but the double had terrible teeth and an underbite, meaning his lower teeth go extend more far forward than the upper. He also reported how the Red Cross had arranged for Saddam's wife to visit him while in U.S. custody, and the U.S. refused to turn him over to Iraqis, who I think would have identified him immediately as one of Saddam's doubles. She came out from the visit saying, "This is not my husband. This is a double. What have you done with my husband?"
Yeah, I remember that.
It was fairly sensational at the time. Yeah, so I decided to follow up on Joe's research and obtained a copy from an impeccable source. The U.S. command in Iraq had a pack of 52 cards and the ace of spades with Saddam Hussein, and I compared the image they had of Saddam with the two that Joe had been studying, and indeed he was right that the real Saddam had excellent teeth and an overbite versus the double. So what happened appears to have been the following, as Yvonne and I reconstructed it. You can find in the articles we have in the chapters we have in the book originally, this happened already on 7 April 2003, just 3 weeks into the invasion of Iraq, that Bush was going to fly onto the Lincoln and announce that we had taken out Saddam Hussein. But someone realized that three presidents, Carter, Ford, and Reagan, had signed executive orders forbidding the assassination of the leader of a foreign nation. So if he'd said that, he would have been violating the law. So they chose not to announce it. Instead, they just talked about, you know, having accomplished their mission in Iraq, and he didn't use the line that the tyrant has fallen, but it was nonspecific, and nobody really understood what he actually meant by that. He just worked it in as a line, and it turned out that, meanwhile, Chris Wachter at home in Orange County in California was feted at the Crystal Cathedral by the Reverend Robert Schiller, who has this huge church, and his services are broadcast by television. So he feted Chris Wachter for taking out Saddam Hussein. It was all extremely explicit. And when that went out broadcast, Chris was ordered back to the Pentagon the following day, and they told him at Langley, while they admired his flying skills, that officially Saddam had got away. They put one of his doubles into a hole in the ground and claimed to have captured him there, put him on trial, and hung him. I imagine they had an agreement where they told him they would only simulate the hanging, but it would have been too hazardous to have this guy around, so I think they actually went ahead and hung him.
Yeah, I know that they did it on one of their... There's a holiday in the Islamic world called Eid al-Adha, I think, which is the festival of sacrifice. And this is the date it occurred on, interestingly enough. There's this whole kind of underpinning here of how Saddam identified himself with being the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar. And there's these very interesting... The way they even dug him out of the hole that he was hiding in at the time was actually reminiscent of a painting that was painted by William Blake in the same way, also called Nebuchadnezzar. This is a strange kind of, I guess, if you will, esoteric underpinnings of it. But definitely I saw the one with the teeth and also his beard. I know that he colored at certain points, and there were certain inconsistencies in that way. So there's a whole lot to that story that we're not being told. And obviously that's done then in a order so that the boogeyman of Saddam can be continued to be used so that the U.S. and those who control American foreign policy can continue to use Iraq in the future, as they now have, to launch further war into, etc. And look at what happened consequently. The country is still in shambles, right?
That's certainly how it's played out, Heinrich. I think that Bush actually wanted to take credit because Chris Wachter had taken him out and his sons and 50 to 60 members of his general staff, but he was inhibited from doing so. We believe it was Donald Rumsfeld, who'd been around Washington a long time, who realized that he'd be admitting that he'd assassinated a foreign leader, which had been prohibited by three presidents, and then it played out just the way you're describing. The other interesting case, of course, is with Osama bin Laden, because we had this fantastic raid on a compound in Pakistan in 2011, using the Navy SEALs. At the time, politically, Barack Obama was in a lot of hot water. His birth certificate, which is clearly fraudulent, was being much discussed on right-wing radio programs. He was being criticized for not closing Guantanamo, though it was really Republicans who wouldn't let him do it. So they claim, and for having troops stationed in Pakistan. So they claimed the tip about his location had come from Guantanamo. Oh, aren't we glad it's still open? He used troops stationed in Pakistan. Gee, well, I guess we're glad they're actually still there after all. And it swept his birth certificate issue off the front page and posed him for having taken out the most wanted man in the world for a triumphal re-election. But the fact of the matter is that Osama died in Afghanistan on or about 15 December 2001, 10 years earlier. There were local obituaries at the time. He died from the problems he was suffering with a kidney disease and Marfan syndrome. It's tough to get those dialysis machines in and out of those caves in Afghanistan. Even Fox News, interestingly, published a report that bin Laden was already dead on 26 December 2001, which you can still find online. David Ray Griffin, the leading expert on 9/11, published a book about it, Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive. Nick Kohlerstrom published an article about it, Osama bin Laden, 1957 to 2001, which is so excellent, I included it in the book as well. And when they made a film out of the raid on the compound, which was all political theater, and where we had expert reports in relation to scholars, a press release released already in 2006, that the new tapes and audios being attributed to Osama were in fact actually fake, including analysis by Bruce Lawrence, a leading expert on Osama in the world, reporting these were not him. In the meanwhile, I published an article entitled Zero Dark 30, The Deeper, Darker Truth, originally with Press TV, explaining how this was all a sham political theater, that even the photograph of Biden and Hillary and Obama watching a big screen TV was simply a stage photograph, because Leon Panetta, who was then the director of the CIA, explained how for the first 20 or 25 minutes there was no live coverage. Even though the photograph was published as though they were watching live coverage, the whole op only took 20 or 25 minutes. That meant there was no live coverage of it. The whole thing turned out to be a fiasco because the helicopter exploded in the compound and killed a whole lot of people. I mean, it was quite a mess when you eventually put all the pieces together. But it served very well as political theater to benefit Barack Obama and his reelection.
Yeah, exactly. It's very interesting watching what happened here, of course, and even the way that, bin Laden's body was dumped at sea. Wasn't even the SEAL team was there was an the chopper was shot down, as you know, later, and all these things to cover up the trail.
Yeah, there are two different stories about what happened to them, but they wind up dead either way. One is that they actually happened at the compound, that the raid was a fiasco. And of course, local residents asked whether they'd ever seen Osama bin Laden, confess they never had, and that the photograph of a man watching a TV with a clicker was actually the owner of the compound, not Saddam. The other story was they were loaded into an old Chinook helicopter, too many in the helicopter, and that it was shot down. I think they didn't want any leaks. Anyone who'd been involved in it was not going to be out to talk about it and undermine the credibility of the administration, which my opinion is about zero on this. In this regard, at least.
Yeah. So this was maybe done as a way to try to, heighten the credibility and get public support that something's being done. I remember it clearly. I mean, they people were out with, American flags outside of the White House and cheering, there's like finally victory.
I know. Americans are very gullible. And we go for all this nationalism, patriotism, militarism. It's shameful how much we have degenerated from a nation that actually respected other nations abroad and were major contributors to the founding of the United Nations to being the biggest bully and aggressor nation in the world. Nowadays, there's no subtlety about it at all. It's our way or the highway. We'll send in the Marines. It's embarrassing. As a former Marine Corps officer, I've been profoundly distressed by the recent developments in our foreign policy and other actions taken by this administration. It's just not right.
Yeah, and I always like to point out as well that the neocon machine that took over American foreign policy is certainly very happy to do the bidding of Israel as well, and that should always be pointed out in these relationships or in these kinds of events, that they're more than happy to help them along,
Yes, well, Cynthia McKinney, who was there, has revealed that members of Congress, when they arrive in Washington, or asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel even ahead of those of the United States. And those who refused to sign, as she refused to sign, are subjected to their next reelection, a well-financed opponent who, you know, given all the money in the world to drive them out. I'm afraid this is a way that the Zionists through the AIPAC lobby, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, they call it Public Affairs Committee, have been able to exert a disproportionate influence over Congress, where even JFK forced the World Zionist Council to register as a foreign agent. He would have done so with AIPAC as well, but no president since has had the courage to undertake that very appropriate move.
Yeah, that's something that has to give and break if America is to take, if Americans are to take back their own country again and get their foreign policy under control, unfortunately, but it's just how it is. Ula, let me ask you a little bit about Saddam or Osama bin Laden, if there's anything else you want to add to what we've been talking about so far here.
I just want to add that the many people say that, oh, come on, you just see conspiracies everywhere if you start talking like that. But if you turn it around, you will see that when you dig into these things and really look for the proof, it will lead you back to the same place, the exact same people, the exact same players behind the scenes. And it's just, in my opinion, the power structure that took over that day, November 22nd in 1963, when they killed the last real president, in my opinion, John F. Kennedy. They have stayed in power, and one of the things that they have been very, very good at is manipulating the mind, psyops, and all of these things of the global population. And they've just done the same again and again and again and again and again. And we have been, for some reason that I have big problems understanding, how we have been so asleep and so gullible for such a long time that we keep accepting these things. So this is why, I think it's so important to expose it once and for all, so that by showing what they're up to, we can start stopping it, predicting what will happen, and then make it come to a stop.
Well, as it says on the back cover, unlike the government, none of us have any reason to lie. I mean, sure, some might now and then, but... this aspect, I think that we're trusting. Many people are, we're hardwired that way. Well, what's the reason to lie about these things? And that's still one of the main reasons why when people tune into the news, the nightly news, then that's the truth. That's what's going on in the world, and that's what's going to be important, and that's what people care about. And I think slowly but surely, though, I think we're learning in a roundabout way, a lot of people anyway, not the majority by far yet, unfortunately, but we are learning that things are not as they seem. So it just needs to head more in that direction. But I agree with you. I get what you're saying. It's unfortunate, but we have to stop being so naive about these things and realize that there is a very beneficial aspect to them lying to us, you know?
I just want to say that I'm absolutely in love with truth. It's so pure, so clean, so simple. And one of the things with truth is, it fears no investigation. It fears nothing. But as soon as you got something, some conspiracy or some, dark things going on behind it, it gets totally covered with all of these lies, infiltrations. People start killing each other off because they're fearing leaks. And anyone that will get anywhere near these conspiracies will be fought back. So I say, like with the Holocaust we were talking about before, with all of these things, there should be a total openness, you know, around the truth. That why are they hiding it? And but it's so clear that something is being hidden, and because of that, we just need to track these lies backwards, and it will lead us to the real truth.
Yeah.
And as I'm sure Ole would agree, once you see through one of these scams, your eyes open to the others. I mean, it changes your mindset. You realize, my God, if they could fake us out over that, such as the moon landing, for example, or the Holocaust, what is there that we could not be deceived about? Where, you know, Osama and Saddam become relatively trivial cases in light of the major ways in which we've been deceived and misled.
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. It's it is shocking, and it is about that aspect of the more kind of absurd and outrageous it is, the more, you know, prone people are to believe it. But we come back to human psychology at the end of the day as well, because we have an aspect that if if the majority of people believe something, then most people are going to treat it as being so. Obviously, that's a fallacy, which is appeal to popularity or appeal to people actually overall. And that's very difficult to pierce through and to get through to people on that level. What would you say, Jim?
There's a combination there. It's called the appeal to popular sentiments. If most people believe it, therefore it must be true. But also it plays upon cognitive dissonance, the psychological phenomenon illustrated by a woman who discovers evidence that her husband has been molesting their daughter. She's so intimidated, it's so threatening to her core beliefs that she simply suppresses and denies the evidence. And years later, when the truth comes out, she's at a loss to explain why she didn't deal with it at the time. Most Americans, for example, want to believe their government is protecting and nurturing and would not, for example, as in the case of 9/11, sacrifice thousands of American citizens to promote its own political agenda. And yet that's exactly what happened. They believe we are told the truth about the moon landing, even though it was a political stunt to try to secure the impression that America was ahead technically and scientifically of the Soviet Union, which was manifestly not the case. And these others, for multiple additional political reasons, the Holocaust being, of course, the most spectacular because of the political benefits to the Zionist endeavor to promote the interest of Israel, regardless of the truth. In fact, truth seems to have nothing to do with the Zionist program whatsoever.
Absolutely right. Now, let's talk about some more recent events as well. I know that you've, Jim, been talking quite a bit about Jade Helm, the federal military exercise here, that and we've seen back and forth in the media as well, treating it that these are some kind of just, kooky conservatives that believe that this is something that's going on or whatnot. And it's a very efficient way for them to polarize. They always do it in this way. But what would you tell us about what this was all about and what is happening with Jade Helm?
Well, there are hundreds and hundreds of reports from ordinary citizens who, using their cell phone cameras, have taken photographs, they've done videos, massive movement of military equipment all over the place, largest convoy ever seen in the history of Colorado. When I look at one of these massive assemblages of military equipment, I recognize it has to be for immediate deployment. Otherwise, you encounter insuperable maintenance problems because they have to be lubed. They need oil changes for that. You need a garage and a lift. As a former Marine Corps officer, I say, this is all profoundly troubling. We have a series of Walmarts, five at least, that have been closed. It turns out there's a longstanding agreement between FEMA and Walmart that if FEMA ever needs these facilities for any purpose whatsoever, the Walmart will relinquish them. They've given false claims that there are problems with the plumbing. There are no problems with the plumbing. No attempts have been made to get permits to repair the plumbing. They're modifying the Walmarts. They're putting up 8-9 foot fences around the Walmarts. They're covering up their windows with plastic so you can't see what's going on inside. They're ripping up the floors. A friend of mine, more expert in this area than I, says it's they're putting down patterns of electrodes. So when they contain detainees inside what will be a makeshift prison cell, they can stimulate them electrically in their bare feet and induce pain or render them unconscious or even kill them. They have put blast-proof doors on some of these Walmarts. Those run $100,000 to $200,000. This all contradicts the idea that this is a normal training op. Nothing's normal about this. The suggestion is made is just National Guard 1,200 troops. That's all ridiculously false. There are more than 1,200 armored personnel carriers alone involved in all of this. They claim they're training to infiltrate cities for future infiltrations in foreign cities. Will Americans stick out like a sore thumb in a foreign city? You can't prepare for infiltrating in a foreign city by conducting an operation in an American city. It's all ridiculous, yeah, what we've been told by the government. It's one lie after another. These Walmarts are going to be used as command and control centers. They're going to be used as bases for logistic resupply. That's what Walmarts are. They're sources of food and supply. Now they're being restocked with military equipment. You need a tank? Well, just call your local Walmart. They'll provide you with a tank. Right. It's all very frightening, and it's expanding in its scope, and we have a whole lot of evidence to support it. And while you might take these hundreds of reports from citizens individually as uncertain or questionable, when you look at the whole panoply, these hundreds of data points, they convey an unmistakable impression of what I regard as the greatest threat to freedom and democracy in the history of the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, I also wonder what the motive also of this is, if it is to Because obviously we see an explosion of this in the alternative media. We see a worrying aspect of this coming out, and that's very understandable. And then at the same time, they deny it, you know, in the mainstream media.
Well, let me make a key point, which also has to do with this NSA surveillance program. The Patriot Act has been defeated. Mm-hmm. They're going to try to resurrect it in the form of the American Freedom Act. All these names, of course, are grotesquely distorted because they're actually subverting the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I mean, this massive surveillance has no warrant whatsoever. A Senate Committee on Homeland Security released a report on 3 October 2012 based upon its review of 680 fusion center reports, where fusion centers merge federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity, gathered between 2009 and 2010. And Heinrich, in those 680 fusion center reports, they found not a single instance of domestic terrorist activity, nor any case in which a fusion center had thwarted an intended terrorist act. So the claim that it is all to thwart domestic terrorism is ridiculous and false. We have a former CIA expert, military intelligence with 20 years, saying every terrorist attack since 9/11 has been brought to us compliments of the government, especially by the FBI. They appear to be targeting groups that might stand up and resist the imposition of a military police state by force, including especially veterans. Can you imagine, from the point of view of DHS, veterans are potential terrorists,
yeah,
constitutionalists, Ron Paul supporters, 9/11 truthers, NRA members, members of militias. This is all shocking.
Yeah.
Violation, subversion of the Second Amendment. We even have an interview with someone who'd been trained about this, Jade Helm, and they're going to go into homes and they're going to be searching for food, and where anyone who has more than 7 days worth of food is going to be designated a food hoarder, and they're going to take the food and they're going to take any weapons they have. And the reason, yeah, goes back to Henry Kissinger was asked, you know, we have over 300 FEMA camps all over the country. Why in the world do they exist? Homeland Security has acquired two billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition, not even permissible in combat under the Hague Convention of 1899. When Henry Kissinger was asked how they were going to get Americans to those FEMA camps, he responded with a single word: food.
Really? Yeah, that's right. What is it you have over in America? Posse Comitatus, the act, right?
Yes, that's a statute from 1878 that precludes the use of the military to perform police forces. One of the reasons for the Boston bombing was to bring a massive military force to lock down the city, go through homes one after another in blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment. This was all to get America, you know, used to the idea of seeing a massive military force in a major American city. It's all blatantly unconstitutional, violation of the Posse Comitatus. Afterwards, amazingly, Chuck Hagel, who was then the DOD Secretary of the Department of Defense, said that he thought we had to reconsider Posse Comitatus. And Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's a zealot anti-gun fanatic, said he thinks we have to reconsider the whole Constitution. This is the mayor, yeah, of the largest city of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just amazing. It's amazing how quickly this is going as well. I mean, where do you think this will go, Jim? I mean, are we looking at a military versus citizen kind of scenario in the future, or is this somehow do they want to get to this situation? What do you think?
Well, we even have the military manuals for this sort of thing. And it turns out that the Pentagon did a study in 2012. That discovered that 70% of the Army would not fire on American civilians. The Navy was going to stay out of it. 90% of the Marines would not fire on American civilians. It looks to me as though they're picking and choosing the troops for this to be those who would be willing to fire on the American people. I have a report from an impeccable source, unimpeachable source, that the enlisted have asked their officers what's going on, and they're told it's going to be an ordinary training op, but they're expecting resistance, and therefore they're issuing live ammunition. And I say, well, if it's an ordinary training op, why should they be expecting resistance? And if they are expecting resistance, why should they be issuing live ammo for American soldiers to be firing on American citizens? None of it adds up. It looks as though they're going after those they regard as potential leaders, actually those critics of the government, people who are, yeah, on the radio, who could get information out about what's going on. They want to go in and perform extractions. And a lieutenant colonel at a small town in Texas being pilloried with questions from the citizens who were dissatisfied about what they were hearing about it, admitted that they were going to perform some limited extractions. Well, limited just means it's a finite number that could be very large, but that's ridiculous. No extractions should be taking place of any citizens in the United States. So that appears to be the first stage. And the second stage is to go after their followers. And I think they'll be processed to the Walmarts as a detainee processing centers and then assigned to various FEMA camps, those who don't literally have their heads lopped off at the door.
God, just amazing the way they're working together with Walmart in this way. But do you think it's they're feeling they're losing control, right? But at the same time, if they were to go ahead with something like this, it would be a major, major signal and to the American people that they're willing to do this. I mean, that's...
Yes. You're right. You're right across the board. So the latest reports I've heard is they're moving up the date to the 15 June from 15 July. But even if you look 15 July to 15 September, they're already remodeling all these Walmarts, which is a sure sign that this is the real deal. This is no ordinary training op. An operation that extends over a two-month period is not just a drill. It's an occupation. And now they're moving it up a month because they're worried that the American people are catching on. I'm afraid we may find ourselves in the middle of a civil war, and it will be sooner rather than later.
I know what you. I mean, this has been on the wall for many, many years, of course, and there has been other drills and things in the past that hasn't, bloomed out in this way. But I wonder what the reactions will be, because either will just be complete, I guess, pacification, like you saw when the government, went into the Waco compound kind of thing, that they spread so much misinformation around why they would need to go in there.
A lot of this has been growing over a long period of time, but I'll say this because I was involved in a 3-hour discussion of this about a month ago. One of the most reassuring observations I had would be the max that the force that the government could produce would be 1.4 million, and they're going to be divided, and we have 1.4 million licensed deer hunters in the state of Pennsylvania alone.
Good point. Exactly. Yeah, who knows? Maybe they're willing to take one of these major hits as a way to try to take the guns ultimately from Americans, saying this is just too dangerous. That's it. We're seizing your weapons from now on, even if that entails a civil war type scenario of trying
Americans
to get
Americans aren't going to go for it, Heinrich. No. Americans are not going to give up their guns. I'll tell you, that's a bottom line issue. It's like these forced inoculation. They're talking about a mandatory vaccine program. There are many of us who will say, you can vaccinate our cold, dead arm. We're not going to go for it.
That's right. Ulla, anything to add to what we've been talking about here?
I think that I prefer to have a positive outlook on these things. I think that we're, by exposing them, I mean, so many of us have been working so hard on exposing what is going on. And I think they're getting very, very desperate, because I would say people are waking up in the thousands daily. And the way I see it, I've been waiting to see what are they going to try when they're really starting to get pushed up into a corner. I think Jade Helm is the crescendo they have been saving for later, but now they feel like, oh my God, we need to do it now. We need to do it now before it's too late. And I just think it's going to totally backfire on them.
Ironically, books like ours are going to awaken the people, not just of America, but of the world, to the duplicity of the government. I mean, these kinds of deceptions on this scale are simply overwhelming. And once you see through one of them, really, you're changed permanently. Your mindset will never be the same, which is why I suggest, even on the back cover, that some suggest this may be the most dangerous book in the world, and they just might be right.
Yeah, we'll see also if they move too soon on this, so to speak. They are certainly, feels like they're in a rush in terms of how quickly they want to have achieved this before more and more people wake up. But gentlemen, I think it's a good time to begin to wrap things up here for this time. It's been great having you both here. I want to make sure that we give out the details once again of where people can pick up copies of the book. And please share with us if there's anything else that either you have upcoming you'd like to let us know about, or any other projects or what have you that you have coming up. Let's begin with you, Jim. Give us the details.
Yes, well, I'm very pleased that I will be interviewing Ole on my show, The Real Deal, the video version of which you'll provide the link. And, there's a lot of good stuff there, including a half a dozen shows about Jade Helm, where I don't just talk about the evidence, but with other experts, I present it. So if you want to learn about Jade Helm, there's a great deal to be learned there. The book, and I suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either, is available both at CreateSpace and also on Amazon.com. Check it out. I think you'll find that this is a book that's going to make a difference in your life. Give it a chance.
Right. We'll have, of course, Jim Fetzer's website links up on ours as well. Ulle, let us know if there's something you'd like to leave us with as well.
I just want to say that I've spent the last few months working very hard together with Max Egan, I think, from Crow House. He's an Australian truth seeker and very, very brave man that is doing everything he can to better the world. And Sen Gardner, there's been other people involved as well in this project. It's called the Full Circle Project. We've had people like Ian Crane and Thomas Sheridan, other people like that involved as well. And what we're aiming at is to see if we can, instead of all of these, there's so many people waking up and so many groups trying to make a difference, but we're so divided. And very often when groups start growing, it's okay when you're in a small group, you can agree and you can go for a united way forward. But as soon as these groups starts growing, then you lose it. And there's all these inner conflicts. And I think especially you see the 9/11 movement, it's just an absolute chaos instead of us just agreeing upon trying to solve this thing and move forward. This Full Circle Project, we will come back and talk more about it. We've just done several radio interviews on different international radio shows and so on. The idea is to start a movement, but without any leaders, but a grassroots movement that will, with the tools to aim at a focal point where to really track down what is the problem, and more or less all of the time, whatever the problem is, it comes back to it's the abuse of power, that it's somebody in a government has signed a paper that has allowed for this thing to happen. More or less, whatever the problem is against humanity, somebody has signed it, and we want to make it personal. We want to track it back step by step and put these people up against the wall, not threatening, but with questions that will put them in a position that they cannot hide anymore and make them responsible for what they're doing. And through this website, it's called the Full Circle Project, .net, join all of these different groups, join. And instead of having big groups that can be infiltrated, make all of it in small cells of groups of five that can. Well, it's quite intricate, but I just feel very, very blessed and honored to be part of this whole thing. And it's going to go, hopefully this website is going to go live within a month or so on. And hopefully you're going to see a lot more of it, because this is, it's aiming at giving the normal person in the street a possibility to take his power back and to have a possibility to affect his life in a positive way without being interested in conspiracies or having to study all of these things or anything. We will try to supply the tools of how to do it and how to take the power back, because at the moment our governments have been totally hijacked by super criminals, and it's time for us to turn around the tide and get this back in balance.
Right, we'll make sure to have the link up as well to this, Ulle. But thank you so much for joining us today. And obviously, Ulle, we will speak soon again.
We will indeed. And my website is lightonconspiracies.com. Anybody who would like to support me or Jim in what we're trying to accomplish, of course, Red Eyes as well, the donation button on all of our websites, newsletter, sign up for the news membership, anything like that, because at least I feel I'm surrounded by these beautiful people that are really trying to make a difference in the world. But one thing we have in common is we are not strong financially. We have, all of us are struggling. And so if you want to make a difference, you who are listening to this, please, if you don't know any other way, then support whoever researcher that you respect and that you want to help forward by donating. It can be small amounts, but it will give the fuel in the tank that can help us move this forward, because we're so willing, but we need the way forward as well with the help of you.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for mentioning that, Ole. And Jim, thanks again to you for coming on. Would be great to speak with you more in the future. I think it was a good opening show, and it's great to finally touch base with you as well. Keep up the good work, and maybe we'll get to do it again in the future.
My great pleasure, Heinrich.
So good to have you with us today, folks. Thank you for listening and for entertaining material that you didn't know that you might want to learn more about. We don't ask you to believe anything. We never do. But hear our guests out and look into it for yourself. Check the work if you're interested in learning more about any specific subject. And of course, see what you think and what conclusions you come to. We certainly just scratched the surface on some of the topics we've been talking about here today. But, you know, keep an open mind, but not so much that your brain falls out. We are rational thinking human beings that can spend some time examining evidence that shows us a different side and see if it holds water. This is how we learn and also dodge just believing everything that the government or the media tells you. But we'll wrap up for now. Let me just share with you some of our upcoming guests. Mark Hackard, Jonas Dier, Sophia Smallstorm, Christopher Hell, and Veronica Clark. For now, we say thank you for your membership and for listening and watching. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll speak more in just a few.